You're listening to All Things Considered on WNYC. I'm Mark Garber. It's been more than 20 years since a female investment banker was brutally raped while jogging early one morning in Central Park in one of the highest profile crimes in recent memory. Here's a clip of a police official giving a briefing later that day, April 19th, 1989.
Around her mouth is an article of clothing that was wrapped around her face, and the same article was used to bind her wrists to her face. She had been struck around the head repeatedly, mud on her body. She appears to have been dragged through the woods north into the...
It was a case that hit all the touchstones of modern New York, race, class, and crime. But the five black and Latino youths who were found guilty of involvement and served time in prison were later exonerated. Now Ken Burns, the filmmaker behind PBS documentaries on the Civil War, baseball, and other topics, is coming out with a film called The Central Park Five, and the city of New York wants footage that didn't make it into the final version. Burns has refused to hand it over. He joins us now to discuss the film and the subpoena. Welcome back to WNYC, Ken.
Good evening.
Now, the city is facing a civil rights lawsuit by these five men who served time for crimes that the Manhattan District Attorney later determined they did not, in fact, commit. Can you tell us what's the basis of their lawsuit?
The basis of the lawsuit is that these young men, boys at the time of the crime, were subjected to questioning without their parents and some rather brutal and long time in interrogation, and finally all confessed. They were the most innocent among the many kids rounded up that night, had not been in the system, and were actually, in fact, good kids, and sort of went along and found themselves implicating themselves in this crime, and because of the confessions, went to jail. And so they are suing the city for the fact that they served between almost 7 and 13 years in jail for a crime they did not commit. The real rapist came forward, and his DNA was the only forensic evidence that linked another human being besides the victim.
Now, you interviewed the five men, right? And why does the city think your outtakes might help its case?
I'm not exactly sure. This is a civil suit that the young men started against the city almost 10 years ago, and it's been dragging on and on and on. And we spent a good deal of the time trying to, in making our film, trying to get every point of view and be as fair as possible a portrait, which it is, and we're constantly refused access to police and prosecutors involved. Sometimes calls weren't even returned, but we diligently tried to reach out to them, and we find it very suspicious, I guess, and saddening that here, after the film has been finished, that we've been to the Cannes Film Festival, to Telluride, to Toronto, that we're the closing night at the Dock NYC in November and opening the day after Thanksgiving theatrically, and will be broadcast on PBS, that now they're seeking our outtakes.
Then you're fighting that subpoena, saying your material is protected by New York's Shield Law for journalists. In a statement your office provided to us, your lawyer says that giving in would endanger your ability to make other films in the future. Why is that?
Well, I think that if everyone thought that every aspect of what we did, all the notes we took, perhaps off-the-record comments that were made, would be subject to any kind of government intrusion and investigation, this would have indeed a chilling effect on our ability to make further films.
Ken, also joining us today is your daughter, Sarah Burns, who I understand inspired this film and helped make it. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you, Sarah. I understand you inspired this film through your research that you did while you were a student at Yale, and you wrote a book that came out last year. What was it that got you so interested in this topic?
Well, I was interested in law school and interning for some civil rights lawyers who were then working on the complaint in the civil case, which had not yet been filed. And it was the first I'd ever heard of this story. I was too young at the time to remember it. And I was just fascinated by this story, by the miscarriage of justice and how it had come about. And so I ended up, as you said, writing my undergraduate thesis about it, and then I followed that by writing a book.
Sarah, the city law department said today that you did work for years as a paralegal for lawyers representing the five accused men. If that is true, does that mean that you've taken sides?
No. My work as a filmmaker, as a writer, is completely separate from the work that I did for those lawyers. I was initially an intern when I worked a tiny bit on this case, doing a little bit of research for them. But the 2 years that I spent as a paralegal working for them, I did not work on this case. I worked on completely unrelated things. It was only my interest that was sparked by working there and not anything to do with how we made the film or what conclusions we came to in our research.
Well, Ken, let me ask you, the city says that it has the right to the documents because it says you have become an advocate for the five men, or that Sarah has. Do you think that you and Sarah, as journalists, should be shielded under the law as a journalist?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we have our own private opinions, but the film itself speaks for itself, and it's completely fair. In fact, if you look at the denouement of the film, we could have taken that opportunity to go off and advocate on behalf of this lawsuit and other things, and we don't. We merely indicate that it had been initiated and remains unresolved. That's it. I mean, that's not advocacy. We have our own personal opinions, and as citizens, I still believe we're free to express them, but our film is a work of journalism, and I'll stand by that, and I'll stand by the fact that people are also, who advocate certain positions, ought not to have their records. If we were thinking of, say, a New York Times columnist who had done research and published it, would we expect the government could go in and inspect their outtakes or their notes or their sources at will just because they'd expressed an opinion? In fact, opinion is at the heart of our first, and it's by no accident, First Amendment to our Constitution.
Now, the city is countering that no reasonable person could have expected the city to participate in this movie because your team advocated for the plaintiffs. What do you make of that?
Well, as I said, my last answer, I think answers that we did not advocate for the plaintiffs at all. We just told the story of what happened from April 19th, 1989, when this, as you described, brutal assault took place, and up to the moment at which the young men had their convictions vacated in late December of 2002. This action and the subpoena that followed it are parts that are not involved in our film.
Ken, many of your other documentaries deal with race, jazz, unforgivable blackness, about the boxer Jack Johnson, Civil War, of course. But you could safely say that they're at a safe removal of history. Is the Central Park case, you think, a big departure for you as a filmmaker?
It's a big departure in that I had the great pleasure of co-directing with my daughter and my son-in-law, David McMahon. It's a departure in that there are some significant stylistic differences, but I think I would argue with the idea that because something is at a quote safe remove that is distant in history, it doesn't have power. I've had to be escorted out of Alabama churches by state troopers because my audience, or some in my audience, didn't like the fact that I had reported who won the Civil War, and they were decided to take it out on the messenger. History is not really that safe. These questions of race are very disturbingly brought up in the Central Park Jogger case, where the language of a progressive modern American city in the late 20th century was echoing the terms of Jim Crow America at the end of the 19th and early 20th century. The wilding, the wolf pack, the black beast, all of that kind of predatory language was evoked again and had often been used to incite the lynching of human beings. We were taking note, as Sarah's original paper did and as her excellent book did, and it was my reading the early writing of her book that inspired us to all do the film. And I have to say, this is not my film, this is our film, Sarah's and David McMahon's and mine.
And let me ask you a little bit about that. You have a long history with PBS and releasing your documentary films on public television. This is kind of a departure for you, releasing this theatrically. Is this your first theatrical release?
No, there have been a couple of others, notably a 1985 film I made on the life of the turbulent Southern demagogue Huey Long that was released theatrically. This is very appropriate for this film. Its size, I think the dynamics of the story and many other things lend itself to this sort of series of festivals that we've been doing and then this limited theatrical release. But it will be followed by the PBS broadcast, which will, of course, garner the most eyeballs, which we're most interested in having see this very complicated and utterly American story.
Ken Burns, Sarah Burns, thanks so much. Documentary filmmaker Ken Burns, we also heard from his daughter and creative collaborator, Sarah, on their new film, The Central Park Five. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
In a statement to WNYC, the city law department says that the interviews that Burns obtained cannot be found elsewhere, and that if the plaintiffs in the civil rights case, quote, want an open airing of the facts, they should encourage the filmmakers not to hide anything, unquote. This is WNYC.